listening to Harrismith Radio, Episode 6. Hey there, I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. This episode of Harrismith Radio is all about growing microgreens vertically indoors with fish, and about growing as farmers through failures that made a Linden couple stronger. First up, I speak with one half of that couple, Claire Dam. Claire co-wrote with her husband, Ken, a heartfelt, honest essay in the summer issue of Harrismith. In it, they detail the hardships they and their families and friends endured when the Dams pulled up their Hamilton Mountain roots and moved to the country. Next, Harrismith editor Catalina Margulis joins me to talk about aquaponics. That's sort of like hydroponics, but tilapia are involved. You'll see. By the way, if you want to read Harrismith magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com, and you can find Harrismith magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harrismith Radio. When Ken Dam was diagnosed with a malignant melanoma, he started getting really serious about the food he was putting in his body. Ken's fine now, but his quest to eat healthy propelled he and his wife Claire into an adventure of homesteading near Coketown, Ontario. It didn't go as planned, but the Dams are still at it 8 years later. They've learned a lot, learned what they don't like, and discovered what they've come to love. I spoke with Claire about their journey. One of the things that really struck me about the piece that you wrote in the summer issue of Harrismith was a sort of a refreshing honesty to it, you know, that I think, I read a lot of pieces about people going back to the land or homesteading, and there's a sort of a romantic sense to it. And I didn't get any sense of romance from the piece that you wrote.
Yeah. So, oh, good. Yeah. I'm glad.
Yeah. So let's, for folks who haven't read it, let's walk through it. You started thinking about getting a farm in the country back in around 2011. So what was happening in your life and your husband Ken's life back then?
Sure. Yeah. So we were living in the city in Hamilton. We had a small lot up on the escarpment. And he was diagnosed with malignant melanoma. So that turned out to be that it hadn't spread. He had surgery, a couple of surgeries, and it was he was all clear. But what that did is it was a catalyst for my husband to really get invested in where his food came from. And that just took us down the rabbit hole.
Right. And you had more of a background with alternative medicine and natural foods in your family, right?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So my mom is a certified aromacologist. She's an inventor of products using aromatherapy. And yeah, that was just more of my lifestyle. We grew up on a horse farm. We had chickens when I was little. So yeah, that wasn't totally new to me. But it was really new and really exciting for my husband, just to see just to get a sense of the truth. He was taking ownership of his health and what he was putting into his body, kind of like, realizing that food is medicine.
Right. So at this point, you've got a small garden up on the mountain and you're doing a lot of research to figure out what to buy, where to buy, what to do with it.
Well, yeah, we turned the backyard into a bunch of raised beds. We got some hens for eggs, which was illegal. Well, still is illegal.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm in Hamilton. I can't raise chickens. Right.
Yes, you can. I can tell you later. legally you can't, but it's something that we actually feel really strongly about that you should be able to do.
Right.
Anyway, that's a whole other thing.
Okay.
But we were just trying everything, and we still kind of are to this day. We just are trying new things all the time to see what we like. So the city was really much a time of experimenting with livestock and plant, like vegetables and stuff. But what it did is it made us realize that we really liked it and we needed more space.
Right. So then you eventually buy a property in Copetown, which is near Hamilton, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. We looked for about 18 months. We looked for a good property.
Right.
My husband was also, I keep saying my husband was into it. He is the researcher, and I'm the enthusiast. So he researches it, and I get excited about it. So.
So it sounds like the research went well, but the enthusiasm was a bit of a problem, right?
Yeah. Well, no, in the early days, I had tons of enthusiasm until the romance of a lot of it had worn off.
So tell me about that, because you started with good intentions. You did some background gardening. You had a background in gardening. Your husband did all that research. You've got this property. Mm-hmm. So what went south, and how did it go south for you?
Yeah, what went south? Everything. So we just took off a really big bite. We were both working full time. I was a photographer. I had my own studio, and my husband was working for a labor union. So we're both full time. And then we come home. It was 7 acres. I had been fallow for about 14 years, which basically means it was just wilderness. It was just 7 acres of wilderness that we were beating back every day. And then we had all these great intentions. We understood principles of permaculture and how those things, you want your farm to work together, not like the animals should work with the plants and so forth. So it was hard to kind of get into chickens without being like, oh, well, then the chickens should be moved into the garden patch to clean up the bugs with the tomatoes. And then if we get cows, then we'll move the chickens in. So there's just, you kind of have to, we felt like we had to do it all at once.
Right. So it's sort of like Dr. Doolittle. You know, you're having all these zoos and stuff. It reminds me of the shows where there's a kid that has a menagerie in the backyard and stuff, right?
Yeah. No, it was exciting at first. And we did accomplish a lot, but there was a lot left undone because as much as we researched, at the end of the day, we didn't have the skills to get things done efficiently and well, and we didn't also have a lot of the tools that you learn what tools you need and don't need just through experience. So that was, I think that was very draining for us. It was just, we were constantly learning and failing and also ill-equipped.
Right. And you were missing a lot of family occasions, and you were also, borrowing the time and the favors of family members. So tell me about how that went down.
Yeah. there was one day where we had ordered 1,500 little trees, different kinds. There was fruit bearing, there was shade giving, there was all kinds of different trees. And we had some family and friends come, and they planted them all with us, 1,500 trees, all around 7 acres. And then it was hard to report back to them every once in a while that half of them had died. and then a bunch more we couldn't find. And then we moved to another farm. So it was just, their romance and their excitement to get involved was waning quite a bit because the projects were just never ending and they were so overwhelming.
Right. And did, before you moved out from Hamilton to Copetown, to the Linden area, did any of your family members or your friends say, Claire and Ken, what are you doing? Or was everybody in the kind of romance mode?
Yeah. No, everyone was in romance mode. I think my parents, who had a horse farm, were, when they saw the property, they were just saying things like, this is a lot of work. We knew it was going to be a lot of work. But of course, we did not know to the extent of the work there would be. But everyone still thinks it's really romantic, even when we are very honest about it. Like, I started an Instagram page a long time ago, and it's called Honest Homesteading, because we felt very disillusioned. We felt kind of a little cheated. It's supposed to be this romantic thing, back to the earth, and it is, and there's moments of it. But it's very, very hard. Very hard.
Yeah, so tell me about that, the hardness, that you talked in the piece about you both had full-time jobs. Your husband was a union organizer. You still had a photography business. So you're working in Hamilton. You're coming back, commuting out to Linden, and you got to deal with the farm. So what were your days like?
are days where, yeah, you go into work. Well, you get up and you do chores. So you're kind of seasonally, depends what that is. But there's always someone to feed and everything, water to take care of. And then you go to work, and then you're working 9 to 5 at least. So Ken and I both have jobs where we're often gone evenings to meet with clients, and we're often away on weekends. So there was that as well. But then you come home, and if it's summer, then you work until, you know, 9:30, 10, when the sun is like really gone. And then you have dinner, and then you go to bed. And that was the first year. That was the worst. That was the worst year.
So were there moments when you were going to sleep crying or waking up crying? Or?
Yeah, actually, probably a little bit of both. Usually you're just so relieved to go to bed. No, it's usually you wake up crying. So the worst probably was we were butchering chickens, and we do a lot of it at the farm ourselves, like a lot of the butchering ourselves. And so we were our first time doing chickens. We didn't even have a plucking machine, so we were doing all the plucking by hand. And I woke up the next day of a long weekend of this, and I started crying, thinking about doing it again. So, yeah.
And you also had a permaculture designer come in for a couple of days.
We did.
Yeah, so tell me about that. That's not, you know, in this the story I was reading, and I was thinking, oh, that must have been an interesting couple of days. So tell me what happened there.
It was very interesting. It was exciting because he gave us a sense of what our land was capable of in just 7 acres, what we could accomplish. He gave us a lot of great plans and things to do. We had I think it was a 1 year, 5 year, and 10 year kind of goals. And we accomplished a ton. Like we hit almost our 5 year goals within the first couple of years, which would explain some of our burnout. We shouldn't have done that so early. We didn't even know what we liked, you know, like we didn't realize, and I mentioned that in the article, we didn't realize that we really don't like vegetable gardening. But in the permaculture plan, we had agreed to, well, we need all this space for the vegetable garden. So these are just things you learn through trial and error. And we learned we don't value vegetable gardening very much.
And what do you have against vegetable gardens?
Yeah.
I just did the last podcast I just did with a woman that was just loves vegetable gardens. So this is a complete contrast. So what's your beef with vegetable gardens? What's your beef with beef steaks?
Yeah, really. Okay. Yeah, we get super excited in the spring. We get the ground all ready, and then we plant the plants. And then you have to really take care of them. I don't know. We just didn't
kidding.
Like,
you guys were the researchers. This came as a surprise to you?
Yeah. No, well, and also we planted too much. That was another thing. We planted way too many beans 1 year, like way too many. So I'm out there in the mosquitoes because it was too hot to pick in the day. So I go out at dusk, and then the mosquitoes are out. And I would have to give up at some point. Both of us would be picking because the mosquitoes are so bad. And we're like, okay, well, I guess the rest of these beans are just going to get woody and we can't eat them. So I think we just got discouraged too many times. And I don't know, we really enjoyed working with animals just more. We always grow garlic and onions and just kind of staples. We always have that going, but not to the degree that we had before. Right. We just prefer the interaction with the livestock.
Right. And there's a really interesting moment in the piece where you talk about one of the early things you did is you got a puppy that would help protect the chickens from the coyotes. And then the dog ends up licking the chickens to death. So you got to explain that to me.
Okay. I'm actually looking at him right now, and he's doing a really good job. He was a puppy. He's a very, very sweet dog. It's an Italian sheepdog. It's a Maremma. They're very common on farms, especially in this area. The idea is that they bond to the livestock they are protecting. So even as a puppy, he had to be with the chickens and the turkeys because that was going to be his family. If he was protecting sheep, he would have to be in with the sheep and so forth. So he has to go in with the chickens, and he was just such a sweetheart. He would want to play with them like a puppy. And since we were working, we couldn't monitor him. So, yeah, there was a few times we'd come home, and we saved a number of chickens who were slobbered and and terrified. But there was a number who just, they think they just died from fear.
Oh, man, that's so sad.
I know. It is so sad. But it has not happened in a very, very long time. He's a very good dog now. So.
So you talk a lot about failure, but in the end, you know, sort of in a positive sense, that you're getting stronger from the failure. So tell me what you learned and where you turned the corner. And I guess there must have been a point where at some point you woke up crying one morning and said, Ken, like, I'm done. Like, this was stupid. Yeah. We're going back to town. Like, what are we doing? But you didn't do that. So tell me about that sort of turning point.
I don't know if I can. There isn't a specific point. I think we needed time off. We took the next year off pretty easily. We didn't do a ton. I don't know. I think it was just there is still a romance and there is still a beauty in small scale farming, and especially for us working with animals, there's kind of a relationship with a lot of them, which is energizing. And there's just this thing that happens where you, as a farmer, and I'm big scale farmers have it, I'm sure, and backyard farmers have it, that you get this rest in the winter and then you get bored and then you can't wait for spring. And I think that's just what happened for us. So every winter we'd get refreshed and we'd get new ideas and we would refine our ideas. Right. We did spend a lot of time in the winter sitting around the fire, refining what we had done, what we could kind of cut away and what we wanted to focus on. And that brought us to a place of expertise, right? Because we kept working on things.
Yeah.
But also just separating the wheat and the chaff for us. Yeah, and just what we valued. It was not an overnight thing. It took a lot of time. And I couldn't tell you what it was that kept us going.
Right.
Because it's crazy, isn't it?
And in the end, you ended up moving farms. So tell me about that, because you're in a different farm now than the one that you wrote about in the piece, right?
Yeah, we were very happy there. It was a very beautiful little bit of land. We had wanted my parents to move in with us. And there was so many issues with bylaw that we weren't able to. And there was this road nearby. It's only 5 minutes from our other house. There's this beautiful road we wanted to live on, and the house came up, and it worked out, and it was 17 acres, and it was set up a lot better. Like, the previous owners had already done a lot of the beating back of nature, which we had spent a lot doing at the other place. So it was a good move for us. My parents got to come with us. We lost a really beautiful barn in the move, but that's a side note. But yeah, we continue here. So like right now we have pigs and the cows and chickens and turkeys. Yeah.
That's great. So I want you to take me to the evening where you've got a couple, maybe a young couple, who are all enthusiastic about farming on your land.
And,
and you've had this experience yourself. What do you tell them?
I would tell them to go slowly. Do one thing at a time. And I think to expect, and not in a defeated way, but to expect if they're going to fail. They're going to have their guard dog eat some of their livestock, possibly. You know, they're gonna have pigs escape. You're going to have a whole crop, you know, taken out by something. And it's going to happen. You're going to learn from it. And I wish someone had said that to us. I feel like we maybe would have been a little bit hardier if we had known that it wasn't going to be quite so challenging.
Right. And is that what you told the couple? Is that the kind of conversation you had with the couple who ended up buying the farm?
Oh, yeah. Like buying our other house?
Yeah.
No, sorry. The couple who bought our farm were our neighbors.
Ah. So they already knew.
Oh, yeah. They very much knew. They had been involved with us. In days we would butcher the chickens. It was an amazing move for them and for us. Right. And they've kind of carried on the work that we've started. It's really beautiful.
So do you really feel like you've moved to a new place? Your folks are there. They've had familiarity with raising animals, horses, not cows and pigs and stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you feel you're in the right place now?
Yes, absolutely. We feel like we're in the right place. We felt as soon as we saw the property, we felt like this was the right place where we could really, really let our roots grow, and focus on building some really good infrastructure, which is key. It's something another thing we learned, good infrastructure. Right.
And one of the things you're doing, apart from raising hens and chickens and pigs, is you're a foster mom, right?
Yeah, we're foster parents.
Right. So what's that like? Because it's primarily babies that you have?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's that like in terms of how that impacts the farm, what the kids get out of it, if they get anything out of being on the farm like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think since they're babies, it's hard to tell exactly.
Sure.
Research would tell you that a calm environment, being outdoors, being in nature is always good for people's spirits. But as far as the farm, probably Ken would be a better person to ask because he's impacted more by the fostering because I'm not as involved. I was out there with him all the time doing things, moving stuff and handling animals. And now I'm not. And now I'm more inside. Right. So that's sad. And I know it's just for a season. I know it's not forever. It's something, it's also something that we really wanted. It's something we wanted to do.
Right. Well, I'm glad you're doing it. And it seems like, I mean, you guys started this journey because of concern for Ken's health, and I think probably spiritual as well as physical. So how has that ended up for Ken?
Oh, yeah. I often tell people that when I got married, I did not marry a farmer, and now I'm married to a farmer. It's brought out this part of him that no one, like not even him, knew was in him, that this passion and excitement for the land and very specifically restoring the land and taking the land that's been kind of brutalized by modern farming and taking it back to a place of health. And that's a big passion of his. And like I said, I'm not the researcher, so he could talk more about it. But I enthusiastically support him in that.
Right. Well, that's great. Well, I'm really glad that things worked out for you. And I'm really glad that you shared your story in the magazine, because it's one that I think that people need to hear and don't hear as often as perhaps folks should, so that they're prepared for sort of the reality rather than the romance so much, right?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, cool. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was Claire Dam from her farm near Copetown. Aquaponics isn't a new idea, but it's one that improving technology has made more and more practical. The idea is simple. Take the symbiotic relationship between plants and animals on a farm, in soil, and bring it indoors. Now replace the soil with nutrient-rich water, cows and pigs with fish, and root vegetables with microgreens. That's aquaponics. Catalina Margulis wrote about the process in Harrismith. We chatted about how going wet and vertical might be a lifesaver where local matters and space is at a premium. Catalina, thanks for joining us. I was really interested in your piece about aquaponics. Tell me exactly what aquaponics is, because it's not hydroponics. What's the difference?
I guess a big differentiator is aquaponics uses fish. So the fish waste feeds the plants, and then the plants clean the water, and then the water comes back, clean water comes back to the fish. I think it's like a close loop system like that.
So it's very much like farming in the sense that you've got animals and you've got plants, and the animals eat the plants, then they poop, and the poop goes to the plants. And so it's just like a farm, except it's a farm with water instead of with soil. And it's sometimes also vertical farm, right?
Exactly. So the two farms that I profiled for the summer issue in Mississauga and Burlington, they were aquaponics, but they're also vertical. So they're maximizing the space of the warehouse. Whereas the Mississauga Food Bank, say, that I profiled a couple of years back, they were not vertical, but they were using fish and feeding the plants that way. And then the plants in turn feed the fish.
So as well as being vertical, it's indoors, right? We're growing stuff in water indoors with fish.
So this is an opportunity for urban growers, especially to be able to grow, you know, in garages, in warehouses. And especially when you do it vertically, they can compete with some of the larger farms out there. because they're making use of vertical space as well. But just the fact that you don't need all this horizontal swath of land, and it can just be, you know, some drums of water and fish, and then that's enough to grow the plants that you need to grow.
So one of the advantages is it's highly efficient, but it's also highly efficient in terms of use of water, right?
Yes, exactly. So that's been a key thing for them, is the fact that the water kind of gets recycled. I think there's very little water loss, especially with the Burlington one that they mentioned. I think it's just the water loss from the plants themselves, evaporation. So very efficient that way. I think the main issue for them has been, because these are indoors, they're using a lot of energy in terms of light and heat. They are finding ways around that, better light bulbs. And I think the interesting thing is with the whole cannabis thing, you know, happening for Canada, that's also creating more interest and more growth in providing more efficient energy in terms of people who are using light to grow in the absence of actual sunlight.
Critics of it might say this is kind of like a veal feeding pen for fish and also for plants. I mean, it seems like kind of a very sterile, robotic, modern, futuristic thing. And it doesn't feel like farming to some people, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the romantic idea of farming is putting your hands in the earth and having that interaction with earth. So that's definitely lost in the process. It definitely feels like a bit of it has to be very clean. So that's got to be a big concern for them. And maybe it does feel sterile as well. But I think, obviously, if land is not an issue, then farming is great. But in places where, you know, space is an issue, or places where they don't have the quality soil for growing, then this is a really interesting alternative that opens up a lot of opportunity for people who don't have the same kind of resources.
I think it's a really great idea, and it's a really interesting idea. And obviously, with an expanding population and our concern about water, and that was what the whole summer issue was about, it's a really good idea mm-hmm. in terms of conserving water. But I get the sense that they're struggling in terms of acceptance from, say, for example, the organic community, who's saying, look, you're not using chemicals, but you're not using any dirt either, right?
I mean, I think like everybody just needs to catch up, right? I think that, you know, the government bodies, they figured out, okay, how are we going to certify soil grown food? And then because this is still so niche, it's still so new, they haven't either thought it was worth their time to invest to look into it and figure out what are the categories and how are they going to qualify this or quantify it. So I think that's just a matter of time. But because it is so new, I mean, there's things that these guys come across because they're the first ones doing it. For example, zoning, right? Like even just getting permits to do these kind of things when the government's like, we've never seen this before. We don't know how to create a permit for something like this. So it's just so new right now. Everybody has to play catch up. But I think the concept is sound and viable in a lot of areas. I don't think it's going to replace farming, but I think it can supplement. And I think the things that they're growing now are still quite small. You know, they're growing herbs and they're growing microgreens. So it's not fully replacing all kinds of produce that we need, but it's interesting and it'll be interesting to see how it develops. And I think it'll be promising for a lot of communities.
That was Catalina Margulis, a fine Harris Smith editor. So here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple iTunes or in your favorite podcast player. And please tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrissmithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.